Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2015. Lecture 20, delivered on April 2, 2015. The title of this lecture is Bonds and Preferred Stock.
Today, Bonds and Preferred Stock. This, in one way, this sounds like two very different topics, because bonds are debt, preferred stock is equity, and never the two shall twain. However, recall from what I had said before about bonds and about preferred stock, the preferred stock has characteristics that make it like a bond in several important ways. One is that preferred stock has a flat dividend, like a bond has a flat coupon, the same coupon every time. Preferred stock has the same dividend every time. Both the coupon and the dividend are expressed as a percentage of the par value of the underlying security. Excuse me. And even more to the point, both of them have priority over the common shareholders. Although the preferred stock does not have to be paid its dividend. If you don't pay the preferred stock dividend, the preferred stock holders can't sue the corporation because they are the corporation. They're part of the ownership structure of a corporation. However, in some very important ways, preferred stock is like a bond. And so it is part of a what you might call the defensive portion of a portfolio, or it's something that you would use if you were in defensive mode, or if you were, say, you had made it to the age of 70 and I offered you a chance to invest in Facebook common stock or the preferred stock of some old state corporation. What would you say?
What?
No. Well, let's go on. Moving on. I hurt something deep in my cranium with that. Okay. Where the hell was? Oh, I know. Okay, here's the thing. Let's talk about bonds first. Now, I've already gone through a lot about bonds, and so this is kind of like old stuff. I do want to tighten up a little bit and give you a few more details about bonds. You know the basics. The face value of a bond is, unless I say otherwise, $1,000. They're usually quoted at a tenth of the actual price of the bond. The coupon is expressed as a percentage of the par value of the face value. A bond that is selling below $1,000 is said to be selling at a discount to par. A bond selling above $1,000 is said to be selling at a premium to par. The maturity of a bond is the date of maturity is when it is paid off. You are paid a coupon twice every year until the last coupon payment, at which time you get one last half of a year coupon payment, and you get your face value back. Past that, though, there are a lot of different things that go on behind the bond. And I mentioned this before. There will be a time when you have, as a corporation, you borrowed $50 million. And so at some point in the future, you're going to have to pay back that $50 million. You've been paying the interest all along. You have been servicing the debt. And then at the end, you must retire the debt. And at that point, you're on the hook for $50 million. Now, those who originally lent you the money, the bondholders, the primary bondholders, are going to make sure that that money is there. So they're going to have some kind of a provision, like a sinking fund. Okay, you're going to owe us $50 million in 20 years, so we're going to expect that you put money into this bank account every year so that you have $50 million at the time you must pay us back. That'll be a requirement, one of the covenants of the promissory instrument. There will be a lot of other covenants, too, in there, and I've mentioned this before. Bondholders want to make sure that there is the maximum possibility that the company will survive and be successful and pay them off, pay their coupon payments and pay the face value off. So the covenants are going to have a number of provisions. For example, there will be a trustee. It will oversee the operations of the company, representing the bondholders to make sure the company doesn't do stupid things that could put the bondholders' claim at risk. They're going to have some provisions like maybe you can't go crazy with dividends because we want you to be growing plenty fast. They might have some say in projects that the company says yes to or no to. No crazy projects that might bankrupt the company and all that kind of stuff. No buying other companies that could put us in jeopardy, all that kind of stuff. So the covenants are going to be part of the bondholders of a bond. And so if you buy a bond in the secondary market, you become one of the people that that company owes. And you inherit, by buying the bond, the covenants that the company signed with the original bond holders, the original lenders. Okay, now, I can divide bonds up all kinds of different ways. And remember, there is technically bills, notes, and bonds, and I'm just going to call them all bonds for the time being. Really? Oh. Okay. Let's see. Now, there are two kinds of bonds. I'll break them this way. One is called, we would call secured bonds. And then there are unsecured bonds. Now, unsecured are often called debentures because there's nothing that the lender can get if the company goes bankrupt. It just gets the general funds that are liquidated. But a secured bond has an asset that belongs to the bondholders if the company goes tap city. Is that out of focus or is it just me getting old? The light. Oh, there's an idea, yeah. There we go. That helps. Yeah, that does. Thank you. Okay. Now, in the event of a bankruptcy, the company will have to liquidate all of its assets, and then those will be allocated among the debt holders in order of their priority of claim. Now, if a bond is secured by an asset, that does not become part of the overall money that all of the debt holders get to take from. That belongs to those who had that secured bond. Now, the promissory note, in a secured bond, there is an attachment to the security to the bond. Sometimes you will call that a mortgage. Just like in home ownership and all that kind of stuff, borrowing money to own a home, there is a promissory agreement. That is the agreement to lend. And then there would be an attachment that says, in the event that the money cannot be returned in its full amount, then this asset attaches and is liquidated, and the proceeds go to the secured bondholder. So, for example, I might borrow $10 million from you, madam. Now, you say, "Well, I could lend it to you, but I'm not a risk taker." So, I want you to make it so that that factory, that building, is mine in the event of bankruptcy by you. And I'll say, okay, the building itself is attached as a mortgage instrument to the promissory agreement between you and me. And so if I go bankrupt, he wants money from me because I owe him some. You want money from me because I owe you some. You want money from me because I owe you some. You get that building, and they get what's left after that, other things that would be liquidated, okay? So that belongs to you at the end of the day. It's liquidated, and you get the proceeds. Unsecured is essentially just what it says. There's no security. If the company goes bankrupt, they liquidate, and whatever money is not insecured is not claimed by the secured debt holders. It goes to you guys in your proportion. Not in proportion, though, exactly, and I'll explain that in a minute. Unsecured debt. Something I was going to say here, but I can't remember what it is. Okay. The safest kind of debt from the perspective of the lender would be called senior. Senior debt. Now, it could be senior secured debt or senior unsecured debt. Remember, the senior secured debt would have a prior claim over the senior unsecured debt. But then you could have several different paths off there. You could have other assets secured as seniors on other assets. Or you could have subordinated debt off the same asset. I could borrow again on a second mortgage from, let's say, you on that same factory. And you would have, however, yours would be a subordinated claim. It could be senior, but it would be senior subordinated secured on that asset. So you could have senior subordinated. And later, you could even have junior and junior subordinated. This gets actually, in some cases, I have seen companies that had so many different juniors and seniors and subordinateds, some of them mortgage bonds, some of them debentures, that it was just almost, it literally became an argument in court who got what and at what point in the game who got what. I'll tell you an interesting scenario. I might have mentioned that. I don't think I did. But there was a court case, it's been more than a few years. I think it's been maybe 10 years or more back, where a company went tap city. It went into bankruptcy. And so there was the liquidation of all the assets. And you had all these different debt holders stepping up to the plate. Well, this part's mine, and all this kind of stuff. Okay? Well, interestingly enough, this company, even in its last months, was taking orders for merchandise from consumers. And that merchandise was never shipped. It was all in a warehouse. Well, it was a lawyer kind of on his own saying, asked all these people, thousands who had ordered and never gotten their stuff, said, "Would you let me represent you so that you can get your money back, or I'll take a cut of it, but you can get some of your money back?" And they said, "Yeah." And so he went to court with the other debt holders, you know, these mortgage these bond companies, these underwriting firms, you know, these rich banking firms, trusts. And he stepped over the plate and he said, "We get some of this money too. Because, you know, we're debt holders. These, my clients are debt holders. Literally, those were accounts payable. They had. So it's a kind of debt. So they get some money back too. And the bankruptcy court ruled, technically, yes, but they are the very lowest of all possible debt holders. And so because the company didn't have enough to pay off every one of the ones above them, they get nothing. The first claim on those on that inventory goes to the senior bondholders. Then if there was anything left, that would be the senior subordinated. And then if there was anything left from that, it would be the junior, and then the junior subordinated. And then back there somewhere by the outhouse are these consumers who bought stuff. Yes, they have a claim. They had a debt. But it's way too far back. Yeah. In fact, that's the next thing that I bring up. Thank you. As a matter of fact, I was getting off on my own tangent there. It's simply that, obviously, senior debt is safer than junior debt. Senior debt is safer than senior subordinated. Senior subordinated is safer than junior. Junior is safer than junior subordinated. So what you'll see is a ranking in terms of risk. And as such, you will see higher coupons being paid for riskier debt. So you would anticipate the two bonds that a company issues at the same time, one a senior mortgage bond and one a junior debenture. The junior debenture is going to carry a substantially higher, it will have a higher coupon, simply because it's a riskier instrument. So you're going to have to induce investors, lenders, to lend money by offering them a higher rate for a lower quality instrument. Now, in many cases, in real life, that difference in coupon can be actually pretty small. If you've got a company that's just borrowing money, the company has billions and billions of assets. Its income is, its net income is incredibly great. Its EBIT, just massive. Its times interest earned is 20 times. There's really not going to be much of a difference between the senior bond coupon rate and the junior bond coupon rate. It might be maybe as much as 100 to 200 basis points, but really, even then, it's not generally even that much. But the interest rate will be a little higher. So here's a problem. A company has, and this is a simple problem. We'll just do it as a simple problem. $10 million in senior mortgage bonds $4 million in senior subordinated on the same assets and $6 million in senior debentures and $2 million in junior debentures. The company goes bankrupt. The secured assets, the secure assets sell for $12 million, and the remaining assets for $3 million. Who gets how much? To stay frosty and you walk through it. There will be one of these on the quiz I'll be putting up this weekend. I usually put one on the exam two. They're not complicated, just make sure. Okay. Here's what we've got going on. We've got a $12 million in secured plus $3 million unsecured. So the company liquidated for a total of $15 million. Okay? Senior mortgage bondholders. How much do they get? $10 million. There's plenty, so that leaves $2 million left for them. The senior subordinated mortgage bond holders. How much do they get? Huh? They only had four. So. But there's only $2 million in assets that were liquidated off it. Nevertheless, they get $4 million. They get two from what was left from the liquidation of the secure assets, and then they get two from this, so there's $1 million left. So, now let's go to the senior debentures and the junior debentures. So, how much do the senior debenture holders get? $1 million. How much do the juniors get?
Nothing.
Yeah. Sorry about that. There. Let me pull it out just a tiny bit here. There you go. See how it works? Nat, yeah, go ahead. The order in which you are paid. In other words, the seniors get the best. Get theirs first. It states it. So in other words, what would have happened is I would have borrowed. If you were the bond issuer, let's say, you would have borrowed on the asset $10 million. Then maybe a few years later, you needed some more money. So what she would do is she would go and talk to the underwriter about securing a new bond issue off the same asset. In personal finance, that is actually called a second mortgage, and that's exactly what it is. And you can even get third mortgages, but it gets to be scary unless the corporation is really, really well heeled. Now, if this asset is obviously some incredibly valuable thing, and it's like $50 million asset, you might be able to borrow $10 million senior, $10 million senior subordinated, et cetera, and no one's going to sweat because the asset is worth so much. Yeah, go ahead. You're saying, wait. Tell me where you want. Right?
In between the seniors, in between right there.
Right there.
Junior mortgage, would they get the $1 million?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because it was secured, and that, of course, is the key there, is that securitization of it. Now, some companies will secure, they'll secure off a building. But companies will secure off things that aren't even physical sometimes. They'll secure off maybe their accounts receivable. They can secure off a lot of different things in this trick. Sometimes, I don't know if I've ever seen it personally, but I know I've been told this, that there are companies that even have, they'll secure borrowings off like brand names or something like that. I can't remember what it was I heard, but it seemed like it was not physical property. It was intellectual property that they were using as their security for something. But, you know, as long as the company is in very good shape, these kinds of bonds are still quite safe. Now, remember also that in this world of stocks and bonds and all that kind of stuff, I also want to make sure that you know about and remember that I talked about call and callability and convertibility. Callability and convertibility. And there's another one. I haven't mentioned this one. There's one called putability. Putable bonds are out there too. Okay. They are sort of like the opposite of the callable bonds. Now, a callable bond is a bond that the company can pay off early. Now, it would do that if, let's say, interest rates were such that when they first issued the bond, they had to give a coupon rate of 8% to attract investors. But the interest rate environment has fallen has softened quite a bit, and now they can issue such bonds for a considerably lower coupon, let's say 5%. So if there's a call provision and they are within the call window, the company can say, okay, we are going to call in those 8% bonds and refi with 5%. They might even do something like, well, we originally borrowed $10 million on 8% senior mortgage bonds. So what we're going to do is, because these were callable, we are going to now refi and borrow $15 million with 5% senior mortgage bonds. They'll pay off the $10 million to the existing shareholders, and they'll, with that $15 million, they'll have $5 million more to go forward with for new projects. And of course, the 8% coupon bond holders are going to be royally pissed because they were expecting to get 8% for 20, 30 years or whatever, and now they get their money back, and because interest rates in the economy have fallen, they have to reinvest at the lower interest rate that is adverse to their interests, their desires. So in other words, callable bonds, the lenders, in order to allow for a call provision in the covenants of the bond agreement, are going to ask for a higher coupon rate. 8%, you want to be able to call this in the last 7 years of the bond's life, you're going to have to try 8.8%, try 9%, something like that, simply because there is a risk to us in this. There's an interest rate risk in this to us because we're giving you this right. That's a call provision, and you saw that yield maturity, yield to call, and you'll, of course, see that again on the final exam. I know, don't get excited. I know it's fun. Now, here's the other side of it, putability. Some bonds are issued in such a way that the bondholder can put the bond back to the company. Pay us off now. Does anyone know, this actually exists within normal loans that you might take out? Mortgage loans, car loans. Does anyone know what this provision is called in normal loans? And this putability provision is in almost all consumer loans. But its triggers are somewhat arcane. Does anyone know what it's called in consumer loans? You all have putables. The lender can say, pay me back all of the money now. The putability. It's called putability. They're putable bonds in corporate. In consumer, they have a name. And I'll bet none of you know it. I'll bet none of you knew that there is such a thing in your loan agreements. And I can guarantee you that it is in every loan agreement, consumer loan agreement, you will ever take out or have ever taken out. No one knows what it's called? It's called an acceleration clause. It's called the acceleration clause. Now, in consumer loans, the acceleration clause is usually, but not always, triggered if you miss more than a certain number of payments. So in a mortgage loan, if you've missed two mortgage payments, the company will invoke the acceleration clause, the putability clause, and say, you must pay off the whole loan now. That's how they take the house back from you. With the acceleration clause, they say, oh, you don't owe two payments, you owe the whole mortgage because you triggered the acceleration clause. That's how they get the house back from you in the court. You are on the hook immediately for $150,000, not two payments of $900 each. You're now have to pay the loan company. So even if you catch up on those loan payments, they'll say, I'm sorry, it's too late. You owe us the whole loan because we invoked the acceleration clause. You made us do it. We're just victims. Did you know that was in there? And that's in almost every loan, I would say. And interestingly enough, if you read the very fine print in some loans that you make, delinquency in payments isn't the only reason that the acceleration clause could be invoked. You have to read carefully, but it could actually make your hind leg go up and down reading what excuse they could have to put the debt back to you, to say you would owe it all to us right away. Anyway, that's the putability. And that's what it's called in corporate. And generally speaking, putability is because the company has missed a couple of coupon payments, and so the bondholders say, okay, this is a putable, it's right there in the contract, that we can now say you owe us all of the money immediately or within 30 days or something like that. And even if you caught up with the coupons, frantically tried to it doesn't matter anymore. Once the putability or the acceleration clause has been invoked, it can't be backed off. It is then the agreement. Once it's invoked, it becomes the agreement after that. Okay? Once you are bitten by a vampire, you can't become a not vampire again. You are a vampire forever after that. Did you know that?
Yeah.
On the bright side, you might be killed by Buffy. You know, that's a decent way to die. Okay. Convertibility. I told you about this one before. It's about as bad as you can get. If a bond has a convertibility clause, the company can say, well, we can't pay you coupons anymore. We'll just turn you into shareholders. And, of course, if that's the case, then the equity of the company sucks.com because they are in such bad shape that they can't pay an interest payment on their loans. Well, that means that the owners are already on their way to the poorhouse, and so they're just making the bondholders part of the problem. Okay, yeah.
I have a question. Maybe I should know this already, but what determines like when a company goes bankrupt? Because I was thinking about which one would be better in terms of more secure if you had a putability or if you were, like, had a mortgage. Because if you miss the first couple payments on your interest as a company, does that mean
Let's get into that. That's a good point. I was going to bring that up just in a minute here, but let me hit that right now. The question is this: look, you're a debt holder. The company owe me money. Now, if I have a secured loan, I know that when you go under, I get that building, right? Okay? Now, if it's a puttable, I can kill you very quickly. I can end this nonsense. I have a problem with incentives, though, because as a bondholder, I really, really don't want to kill the company. That's why I will not be horrified if you get protection from me killing you in a bankruptcy court. Because then we can work it out and you might be able to survive and I might get back on your feet. I'll get most of my money if I can get you back on your feet. So there is some reason to want you to stay in business. But at the same time, and this goes to an old saying in options trading, every option is worth more alive than it is dead. As long as I have you alive, there's the option that you could come back from the dead and I could be made whole as a lender to you. If I kill you, that's the end of the story right there. So why would I ever kill you? Can you make a zombie into a not zombie? No. It's too late. I'll kill you. There's nothing else to do. You just do it, and you don't worry about it. You enjoy it. It's a fine line, though. If this company has already just completely trashed itself, it is down so far that there's just no way in hell that it's ever going to come back from the dead, just kill it. On the other hand, there's a problem with letting him live. There's a problem with letting you live. You might simply do more stupid things. And you have an incentive to do some stupid things that you didn't in the old days. You have incentive to trash that building, to do bad things to your company. What do you have to lose? Your company, you know it's going to die. I think it's going to live, but you're an insider and you know it's going to die. You're just going to trash that place. Did you ever hear of an old, one of the first of the hard grunge metal bands called Cramps? It was called Cramps. They had their biggest song. It was a romantic favorite. Come on, baby, let's trash this place tonight. Okay? They had no incentive to keep the place in business because they were very bad singers doing their first album in a new genre. So they trashed that place tonight. You understand the point I'm making here? Is that at some point, I can't trust you to come back. I can have all the hope in the world for you to come back, but you have no hope for yourself to come back, so you're going to trash that asset that I've got the mortgage on. So by the time I finally come to grips with the fact that you aren't going to come back, and I bring you down, and I go and look at that building, well, there was a building there, and now there's kind of like a crater. Enron was a great example. Yeah, go ahead.
With the putability, you wouldn't have to pay the full interest on that, right?
No. Enron, in its last month of operations, Enron was being run by some of the most scurrilous, nastiest, disgusting human scum on earth. One of them was a friend of mine. In fact, he wasn't at Enron at Enron down in Texas. He was working out of Columbus. He was one of their energy traders. They knew the company was dying. The upper level of management, they had set up all of these accounts offshore for themselves, these shell corporations. They were funneling money to themselves in these vast secret accounts in the islands. They've been doing all kinds of bad things for years, and the fist was finally coming down on them for all of these nasty things that they had been doing. They knew the end was near. regulators had finally figured out that one of my favorites that they were doing was they were selling electricity into California, but they had set it up so that the electricity rerouted back out of California as soon as it went in, and then they were reselling it in Nevada. So California was having these rolling brownouts. We're buying electricity. Why are we having this happen? Well, the electricity was not staying in California. It was just routing back around back to Nevada. And all these and regulators were catching them and figuring out, and they figured out that, oh God, there's something really bad. All this money is just vanishing. It's going to offshore accounts. Where is that going? Well, back then it was secret. No one knew, but we knew those guys were doing it. And you see, what they did in their very last month, in order to keep the scam going just a little bit longer, they did a couple of things. One is they issued a pile of commercial paper. Remember, commercial paper is that short-term working capital, kind of working cash management money. Hot, large, credit-worthy companies issue it 30 days, and then the company pays it off. Big companies do it all the time. Well, Enron was a big company, and they did it. They issued a buttload of commercial paper shortly before the end came. But that wasn't their most incredible. You're talking about ballsy. They sold one of their major pipelines to another company. They sold it, which means that the asset transferred out of the hands of the shareholders into the hands of a completely different company. And of course, the money that they sold it for, they shuttled most of that off to their island accounts. Now, when the death came, the debt holders stepped up to the plate and said, oh, thank God we've got these pipelines. No, you don't. Those were sold. Well, we're going to sue that company over there at the bottom. Well, they tried, but the company, we didn't know. We were just as dumb as you. Hey, it's our pipeline now. Kiss our asses. And then, of course, the pensioners. I worked in Texas. I was a consultant in Texas in oil and gas and new energy, new types of energy, high energy density storage devices. And I knew people who worked at Enron 20, 30 years. Their pensions were all Enron stock. That was how Enron did it. If you are our employee, you've got to believe in our company, so you've got to have our stock in your pension. So when Enron went to hell, the pensions, some of these were the, well, almost all of these were the pensions that these people were going to go into retirement on. They were gone. Gone. Ended. That's it. Nothing there. You're 60 years old. You're 3 years from retirement with a pension that you thought was going to be close to $4,000 a month. Well, you're going to have a $0 a month because there's nothing in the pension because the stock went to hell. That's what can happen when you rely, when I believe in you. Okay? So that's why I don't trust you. I don't believe in you. So there is an incentive. Yeah, you could come back from the dead. We've seen it. But at the same time, I always want to remember Enron. And I always want to remember that at the end of the day, the first rule of warfare, never trust your opponent's intentions, only his capabilities, ever. So now, though, with that happy note, let me talk just for a minute about preferred stock. I don't have a whole lot to say. You've seen how to price it. And I've told you about the difference between cumulative and non-cumulative dividends. I want to point out a couple of things. And I think the book brings this up, is that there's a really cool thing that makes preferred stock highly attractive to certain types of investors. Not to individuals. But if I am a corporation, and I want to invest in equity of other corporations, you know, part of my holdings. If I buy preferred stock from a company, the dividends I get from that, that's income, right? You know, the dividends would be income to my company that bought the stock. 70% of those are tax exempt. Tax exempt. So in other words, if I've got, let's say I'm some corporation, I've got a ton of cash and I don't know what to do with it, I might buy and a whole issue of preferred stock that your corporation is pushing out. You know, the dividend won't be big off that, but it's safe as hell. And, I mean, it's there forever. And also, whatever that amount is, let's say that you've made an issue of $100 million of 1.2% preferred stock, okay? Par value, total par value is $100 million. Okay, if it's 1% on that, every year I'm going to get $1 million as my preferred dividend. 70% of that doesn't get taxed. So that gives a big, big incentive for me to invest in that preferred stock. And another thing, too, if I own more than about 20%, I think it's 20% of your company, then even more of that preferred dividend is tax exempt. So what I would do is, if I'm a smart company and I've got a pile, just tons of money, what I would probably do is, you're a private company. Okay, I'm going to buy a stake of 25% in your private company. And then what's going to happen is, you need money now. What I'm going to do is, I'm going to have you make an initial public offering, not of common stock, but of preferred stock. And I will buy all of that preferred stock to boost my investment in you. That way, I am infusing money into your company. I control 25% of your company. And I get a dividend that is more than 70% tax exempt. And as your company grows, because 25% of it is mine, I grow the investment asset that is your company on my balance sheet. Kind of follow the trick? It's nice. And that's why companies do issue preferred stock, but you don't see it very commonly in normal people's portfolios, because our tax laws are such that it is a much more favorable investment for corporate investors than it is for private individual investors. It's just attractive as hell as a way to capture corporations. I can make a captive. I can create, let's say, an insurance captive. An insurance captive. What I'll do is, I'll own 90% of the insurance captive. And let's say that my subsidiary corporations will own the other 10% of it. Now, I want to finance you. I want you to have money. I want to capitalize you. So we're going to have you issue $100 million in preferred stock. Okay? Well, then I and my fellow subsidiary companies will buy the whole. We will self-underwrite the offering. We will buy it from you. Don't worry about it. We'll pay for it. Suddenly, I have capitalized you to the extent of $100 million. I own 90%, well, 100% with my subsidiaries, of you. And anything you make, the residual on it, comes to us as the parent company of the captive. And that's awesome, because that's, by that time, with that kind of a control holding, probably 80, 85% of the money that you pay us in your regular preferred dividends every year is exempt from taxes at the federal level.
Why is it exempt, though? Why is it special about preferred stock?
Historically, back a long time ago, do you remember when I brought up the real estate investment trust, the REITs? I'll explain this again in the next lecture, but essentially, back in the many decades back, there was this belief, there was this push, that taxes should not just be to collect revenue, which is what you think taxes are for. It was part of a, for lack of a better word, neoliberalism that came about in the 50s and 60s. Eisenhower was against this, but Kennedy was more of a modern person. He believed that you could make things complicated and keep them from going to hell. And there were many economists at that time who believed the same thing. Industrial policy. Let's make things really complicated, and then we can, but let's make it in such a way that we're making like complicated machines. So we began to pass tax laws in that era that had not just the purpose of raising revenue, but had the more important purpose of shaping the society. so that we would have a kind of corporation called a real estate investment trust that would have such great tax advantage that money would flow into it, and from that flow, money flowing into it, housing, shopping malls, apartment complexes would start popping up all over the country. By God, they did. Until corporations many years later figured out that that was, they could use these for other much darker purposes. The same was true with these kinds of laws with preferred stock. Essentially, what they were trying to do was encourage companies to finance subsidiary operations and to keep those protected from the vicissitudes of the market itself. See, because you essentially kind of became a public company, but you didn't. So you're not going to get beaten up by shareholders. Any bondholder that comes to bully you, big massive corporation is standing there, we're the preferred shareholders, we own 90% of this, go away. See, and it was part of industrial policy. The idea that we could build a nation and ultimately, to a certain extent, destroy the communist model by this version of capitalism that was, as one famous economist of the time called it, a tension of countervailing forces. There would be the government, the massive corporations, and then the unions. And they would hold each other to account in a dynamic tension, and we would grow as a nation, and ultimately, our economy would just simply obliterate the communist threat. Interestingly enough, it actually kind of worked. But then it went too far, and it kind of went back into the background, and then it came back in full force with a new generation in the 1990s of neoconservatives led by the successors of Ronald Reagan and neoliberals like Al Gore. They said, industrial policy worked once, let's do it again. And unfortunately, the second time, it has not come out nearly as nicely. As I said, the darkness has fallen on it. But it was a pretty damn good experiment at its time, as you can see. That's all I have for you. Go home.